He laughed loudly. I would have done that by now. But you live here with us, and we don't steal from us. Why steal from the poor? We steal from other neighborhoods, where the money is. That was a relief, and a good rule to live by. My life in Paris was, at this point, more retired postal worker than young bon vivant. I would sit in the park during the day, then around 4, go to the supermarket, and return home to cook a depressing dinner alone in my apartment at night. In a weird way, this was probably the closest to the life of a real artist I'd ever get, except, of course, for the not creating any art part. It was solitary, but my eye was still on the prize. That is, this was all just the seedbed for the real payoff, which was, yeah, I lived in Paris in the late 80s. And also, my answer to the question, oh, what did you do there? I'd be able to softly chortle and reply, what does one do in Paris? Nothing. Sorely out of funds, I used my aunt's contact to try to get some work from the woman who owned the knick-knack shop. But unfortunately, she had no openings selling plastic Eiffel Towers. But she did have a contact in the south of France who ran a commune/farm, which took in volunteers to help with the farming. It was really my only option, so I took it. I took a train down to a rural area in the Ardèche Mountains, where I was greeted by a large American woman, her very small French farmer husband, and their two daughters. The farmer spoke no English and barely any French. He mainly communicated in a series of grunts and slugs from a wine bottle. He looked really of the earth, almost half-human, half-botanical, or better described as like a sentient root. A fruit, so to speak. Their farm surrounded a beautiful 16th-century stone house built on a steep hillside, with tiered bean fields carved into the hill below. They led me to my room in an adjoining shed-like structure with a private small bedroom. Before I knew it, I was summoned to the side of the house, where I met some of the other people who were staying there. Without a moment to even process, the farmer, axe in hand, grabbed a rooster from the yard, strode up to me, and put it in my hand, the axe, not the rooster. He then walked up to a tree stump that had a hook fastened in it and jammed the rooster's head under the hook, trapping it. I had not really seen much animal cruelty before, so this was a bit of a shock. He signaled for me to come over and nodded to chop the rooster's head off. Everyone was gathered around, but I just got there, and I didn't want to immediately murder a bird. Seriously, what the fuck? The American woman said, "Just aim below the hook and give it a good swing. All our new guests do it, and tonight we'll make coq au vin to welcome you." But this felt not altogether welcoming. I got shaky, and I tried to hand the axe back to the farmer, but he looked at me sternly as if to say, "You will kill it." I had never killed anything before, with the exception of my neighbor's dog, but that was just because I put vodka in its water dish. Also, I'm not sure that's how she died. It might have been old age, or the vodka. I was really beginning to fall apart now, and the rooster was squirming violently under the hook, and these people were staring at me, so I quickly did a very broad, no thanks gesture. "I don't really kill things," I said. "Replace we for I, and always for really, and you have a potentially good slogan for the army." The farmer grabbed my arm firmly, and before I knew it, swung my hands up, guiding the axe above my head, and then forcing it down on the rooster, chopping its head clean off. It happened so fast, I had no course of resistance. I had killed. Well, he had killed. Well, we had killed. I think it might have been Ted Nugent who claimed that meat tastes all the sweeter if you were the one who's done the killing. As I ate my coq au vin that night, it really tasted pretty much the same as if I hadn't been the rooster killer who cut its head off. Lesson learned. Around 5 the next morning, I was awoken by hard poking into my rib cage. The farmer stood there, with his dog by his side, stone-faced. He signaled to get up. Tired and disoriented, I quickly dressed. I followed him to his truck and got in. We drove in silence, as the sun peeked over the hill, spreading bright morning light onto the plateaus and deep-cut valleys. We drove to town, and then parked in front of a small cafe. Inside, we sat, and the farmer spoke briefly with the man behind the counter. My head throbbed from the wine the night before. The man slammed a bottle of wine onto the table like a sommelier from the Old West. So we sat and drank the bottle in silence. This was my first wine-only breakfast, and it did make me feel a little better, especially considering the we-can't-talk-so-we-might-as-well-drink vibe. But sunrise is a tad early for booze, I think. Around 6:30 a.m., drunk, I was dropped in a bean field to pick beans alone in the summer sun. Then, at around noon, already hungover from breakfast, the farmer picked me up in his truck with his dog, and we went back to the same cafe for more wine. More wine? This farmer's tolerance for drinking and bean picking was epic. At around 5:30 the next morning, I felt a poke, and it began again. Back to the cafe for more vin rouge at daybreak. Holy fuck, how is this sustainable? By nightfall, I'd aged 30 years, and with dinner came way more wine, and the sorting of beans into piles, small, medium, and large, to be separated for the market. It was literally drink, farm, drink, sleep. Day bled into day because it had been 2 days. But by day three, my body was literally breaking down. Mon Dieu, the wine! This was it, my five easy pieces moment. Would I commit to my pretentiousness and eschew American upper-middle-class values forever and stay till my liver became large and French like a swollen leather canteen? The next day, I took a train back to Paris and flew home. As it turns out, even pretensioneers can fail. My failed pickup lines. I couldn't help noticing that you might have social anxiety. Do you work out or are you just naturally tense? Has anyone ever told you that you look like my mother? I've been waiting all my life to ruin this moment. Excuse me, but is this pussy taken? Am I seeing double or do you have two tits? Are you into double entendres? Because if so, can I look under the mat for the key so I can open the back door? Hey, I'm an atheist, but after seeing you, Allahu Akbar! I know this might sound old-fashioned, but do you want to have sex with me in a cave? It seems like you have a head for business and a bod for business. I guess you seem like you're probably in business. You look exactly like a model who I used to have sex with. Is it just me, or are you Jewish? My mother always told me to find a nice girl to settle for. I know you've probably heard this before, but you're a grand old flag, you're a high-flying flag, and forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true, neath the red, white, and blue, with as never a boast or a brag. Should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on that grand old flag. Chapter 11. How I Failed to Study the Holocaust. They say those who can't do, teach, but one could also say those who can't do, write. I think I'm exposing the veracity of this as we speak, or, more accurately, those who can't write, still write. Another truism you might entertain is, if at first you don't succeed, try again. But this one has some very dark undercurrents, because if you're Hitler, for example, trying again is a very bad thing. One would have compelled him to stop trying, because succeeding had some very dire consequences. The ancient art of Tai Chi tells us to stop trying, to give ourselves completely to the energy of the universe, because trying is working against a natural flow. I tried this once in an actual fight at the Dream Machine Arcade in 1982, and I couldn't quite stop the fist that was hitting my cheek with my mind, so this model doesn't always work in a practical sense. But there is something very affirming about not trying. Professional athletes talk about the zone, that feeling one gets in the heat of competition, where things basically become effortless, like intuition takes over and all tension is released, and they can just do instead of trying to do. After college, I was trying to do a lot of things, like the aforementioned moving to France to become a socialist farmer, but finally landed on going to graduate school in Chicago for Holocaust studies to start the process of becoming a teacher. But it also concurrently set in motion the question of what happens to those who can not only not do, but can't even teach? Maybe those who can't teach go into real estate? Or those who can't teach become hobbyist inventors of a food product called Vampagels, the bagels with two holes? Or something like that. But at least I was starting to try to become a teacher, even though trying, as I explained earlier, is against nature. In the late 80s, Holocaust studies was a pretty under-the-radar field of study. Of course, scholars existed who wrote extensively on the Holocaust, but very few universities actually offered whole programs focused exclusively on it. In fact, I was the only student at the university in the program. So yes, I was on the ground floor of what would become a real cottage industry, but the downside was a lot of attention was put on me. Being the only student in a program is a bit like being a prince or a princess. Everything you do comes under heavy scrutiny. I started to notice this early on when I turned in my first paper to my professor on the topic of the authoritarian personality in the context of the rise of Hitler, and he wrote across the top, "Grossly insufficient analysis." I blame the heavy scrutiny. He blamed my substandard work. Soon I would learn that I was very good at grossly insufficient analysis. In fact, if I were to start an analytics company, I would now call it Grossly Insufficient Analytics. So it was very quickly established both that I was the sole representative of the Holocaust Studies program and that I completely sucked at Holocaust Studies. I even attended the inaugural Holocaust Studies conference on behalf of my department, where historians spoke on different topics, and I was so woefully underwhelming that I'm pretty sure Elie Wiesel, the keynote, rolled his eyes at me. A few months in, the director of the department brought me in and asked if I was interested in moving into the religious studies department because maybe my talents were more suited to that. My own department was trying to trade me to another just to save face, and I was the only one in it. What I lacked was, to put it simply, academic rigor. I lacked the facility to find hard truths. I couldn't hold firm historical data. I couldn't maintain a heuristic erection. I just couldn't never forget it up. After the failed attempt to pass me over to theology, they suggested I learn Polish as fast as I could. At least then, that would qualify me to tap into primary source material, and maybe then I could turn this around. Quickly, I realized that Polish is an unbelievably hard language to learn. In fact, it probably would have taken 6 to 12 years for me to learn Polish. Also, I realized this was a way for my department to stop me from writing any more inane material and instead put me in some sort of academic solitary confinement where I would just go away and learn Polish. It would save everyone a lot of wasted hours of my writing and their reading my shitty papers. Literally, the next reasonable step would be for them to buy back my tuition. Accepting that Holocaust studies was a dead end for me, I finished out the year using a lethal combination of plagiarism and eating at Polish restaurants where I could order and hold brief conversations with waiters in Polish on the German killing operations in Poland. Check out Podolanka if you're in Chicago and tell them the kid who talks about the Holocaust sent you. With that, I give you a brief portion of my failed Holocaust memoir in the great tradition of fake Holocaust memoirs and fake memoirs of all kinds of recent years, like those written by Misha de Fonseca, who claims she escaped the Warsaw Ghetto and was raised by wolves, Benjamin Wilkomirski, Herman Rosenblatt, and more. Many have tried to co-opt the monolithic tragedy that was the Holocaust for selfish purposes, and so here do I. Maybe it's the best way to exemplify another common human trait. Those who can't do, lie. See if you spot some of the clues I've subtly placed that expose this memoir as fake. My Holocaust Memoir. Chapter 1. I remember less the way our modest half-timbered house looked, but more the smell. Pinewood, burnt leather, and chakrut. My father smoked a small briarwood pipe with a black mouthpiece and a smooth, almost pellucid chamber. When he kissed my cheek good night, his mustache was redolent with cherry pipe tobacco and kirsch. When the Nazis came, I was 7. I heard a banging and then loud voices. I did what my mother had told me. I took my place underneath the large wooden dresser cabinet in the corner of my room. More loud voices, then footsteps, then quiet. Cold, searing quiet. I waited till dark to emerge. The front door was open and my father's pipe sat upright in the ashtray next to his armchair. I took a deep breath. Pine wood. Burnt leather. Chokrut. From this point forward, everything had changed, and the spirits of the dead walked the earth. I remember myself when I was John Benjamin, and I was 7, and I lived on 64 Rue Marbach. I even remember moments before, but that was someone else. Now, I was a phantom. I walked out my front door and down the walkway, past the precise row of impatiens my mother had planted on Rue Marbach, and into the night, filled with screams and the rumbling of motorcycle engines from some all-black bike gang that was roaming the night streets, like in that movie Biker Boys. Kid Rock was in that, and it was directed by Reggie Rock Bythewood. I decided to be invisible, and walked through Place Kleber with the street lamps burning reddish-orange and groups of drunken revelers casting violent shadows across the cobblestones and onto the buildings that lined the square. Most Jews were being rounded up and sent to Drancy, outside Paris, or so I was told. I kept walking, invisible, through the city streets, until the cobblestones turned to dirt, and the dirt turned to pine thistle and mud. And when I looked up, the densely leaved trees looked like sullen, dizzy giants swaying in the night breeze. I fell asleep, hungry and cold, but overcome with a strange sense of calm, as if the forest itself was reading me a lullaby. I dreamed of my mother laughing and my father sitting in his chair as the tea kettle whistled, and that scene in the movie Biker Boys, when Slick Will, played by Eric LaSalle, yes, the guy who played Dr. Peter Benton from ER, told the character Kid that when Smoke lines his bike up for a race, he doesn't see anything, he doesn't hear anything, just the finish line. Slick Will tells him, cat like that gets in the zone, it's like a gift from God. And then Kid stares right back at Slick Will and says, sounds like bullshit to me. Only minutes later, Slick Will was killed by an out-of-control bike that crashed into him during the end of the drag race. Just seeing Eric LaSalle, spelled E-R-I-Q, pretty ballsy, by the way, using a Q in place of a C or a K, really made me think about that other medical drama, Saint Elsewhere, and that show's final episode, where they show the hospital, and it is snowing, and they pull out to reveal that the hospital is in a snow globe, and the snow globe is being looked at by the autistic son of Dr. Westfall. But Dr. Westfall comes home, and we see he's not even a doctor, but he's a janitor or something, who worked at St. Allegius Hospital, thereby concluding that the whole show had been the convoluted fantasy of an autistic child. That's what it felt like that cold night in the forest of Neuhof, when the Nazis came to Alsace, and the world became broken. My failed book list. Your Kampf, Hitler's second book about your struggle, not his. 1988, Orwell's follow-up about a synth-pop band called Thought Crime. James Ear, a novel about a dude getting laid all the time in the 19th century. The Picture of Laurie Ann Gray, the story of a woman who makes a very poor deal with the devil, wherein she ages at the same rate as her portrait. Waiting on Godot, a play about how tough it is being a server in a busy New York City restaurant. The Most Oedipal Game, The story of an island where you can hunt and kill your father. The Bird. A retelling of the Daphne du Maurier story The Birds, adapted into the famous Hitchcock movie, but with just one bird, one really crazy bird. The Girls. An inversion of The Birds about a group of girls trying to kill a bird. The Old Man in the TV. The story of an old man desperately trying to set up his Apple TV for more than 4 days, only to not be able to do it. David Copperfield, the story of a young man who one day becomes an accountant. The Note, an old man reads from a post-it to his lover who is afflicted with advanced Alzheimer's about where her pills are kept. Chapter 12. Getting High and How I Failed at Being Gay-Bashed. I have always had a contentious relationship with marijuana. The first time I got high was at my friend Mark's house. Mark was my seventh grade classmate and lived in an affluent neighborhood not far from where I lived. His house was sleek and modern and on a large, meticulously landscaped property with varied and unique species of trees, like red ones and greenish ones and greenish-brown ones. I'm not an arborist. And a koi pond in the front. It was like visiting a Japanese temple. His father was a businessman and usually sat in a leather chair with a large unlit cigar in his mouth reading a paper. He looked like he belonged there. He and his chair were in perfect union. The house was sprawling, and as a kid, the prospect of being able to wander into a separate wing with almost complete privacy was thrilling. It was the kind of house where it felt like Mark was more of a lodger and less a family member, like a 13-year-old Cato Kalin. He had an older brother who was a senior in high school and whose main and most memorable characteristic was that he dressed and acted like he was Southern. He wore jeans and a CSA belt buckle and drove a Trans Am with a Confederate flag on it that had a bale of hay in the back. It also had a Dixie horn. Look, the Confederacy was not well represented in New England in the early 1980s, so in this respect he was something of a vanguard figure. A bit controversial, but at the time, just another local kid with a very disturbing and comprehensive obsession with the Dukes of Hazzard, whose parents, for some incomprehensible reason, bought him a tribute car to the Confederacy. Hey, at least it wasn't Magnum P.I., since Ferraris are way pricier. Despite his Confederate leanings, he was very sweet, and coincidentally, the first person to get me high. It was in his room. Country music was playing, and I was uncontrollably laughing for at least an hour. I also remember obsessing about getting an erection, and so I was laughing while forcefully pressing my hands into my crotch, holding back a phantom erection that I kept imagining I was getting. It must have appeared odd, me standing in a doorway, giggling, while jamming my penis and balls into my legs. As much fun as it was the first time, I spent the next week with really sore balls, and that would become a bellwether for my contentious relationship with pot that would continue until I stopped smoking in my early 40s. I guess one could make the argument that as much as I've tried, I am truly a failed pot smoker. Almost every time, I was saddled with some sort of intense anxiety or dissociative experience. But the drive to get this drug to be enjoyable for me was a real goal, seemingly unattainable, like my suburban version of summiting Everest. My brain chemistry and THC are just natural enemies, and in spite of all my efforts, smoking pot would inevitably leave me isolated, rocking back and forth and trying not to swallow my tongue. In my early 30s, after a few months of dating, I decided to take my girlfriend Amy on our first trip together to Toronto. I had a friend who was from there, and he had arranged for his brother, who was a lifelong Toronto resident, to plan some stuff for us to do. Tickets to a hockey game, stuff like that. It was a very hockey-centric schedule, I remember, and that seemed good, considering Amy had no interest in hockey. I found that out during the hockey game, and then after, at the Hockey Hall of Fame, or maybe at the bar after the game that showed exclusively hockey highlights. The second night, we met my friend's brother for a beer at the Horseshoe Tavern, a famous music venue. After a bit, Amy was tired and went back to the hotel. My friend's brother and I stayed at the bar for a while and chatted about hockey. He said his friend was having a party in an apartment nearby, so we went. It was a walk-up apartment and very trap-housey. The party kind of sprawled out over various rooms with people milling about, and in each room a different tableau of party tropes, like people doing coke on a table, and in another a couple in flagrante delicto, and in another a guy playing guitar and a girl on a tambourine with a group of people gathered about. All right, so not so trap housey. We went out on a deck that overlooked the main street, and he lit a joint. I had the premonition, like every time I smoked pot, that I would lose my shit. But I took a hearty puff anyway, and within about 7 seconds, I lost my shit. It must be a curious thing to see me high, because in my estimation, I'm like Schwarzenegger in Total Recall when his woman suit glitches out. 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks, and melts off. Luckily, this guy was a talker, and smoking pot compels more talking, so in this case, and most, I stood silently in a state of pure terror while he made droll conversation. As my mental state started to spiral and the party became a blur of light and sound, I made my way out knowing only that I had to get back to the hotel. Safety. Must go to safety. Must go to the hotel. The hotel I'm staying at. As I got to the street, there were like hundreds of people and hundreds of cars backed up, and that was not good for my state of mind. I was desperate to get back to my hotel, but now I couldn't remember the name of it or where it was, and my girlfriend had taken the key, so there was no hope of finding out. I decided to just get a cab and then figure out what to do from there, like maybe ask the driver to list the names of all the hotels in Toronto so eventually I could hear it and remember. But it was actually impossible just to get a cab. Someone in the crowd said to take the trolley, so I shakily made my way over to a trolley stop and sat there with a group of drunk women who were waiting as well. I sat like rigor mortis was setting in. After what seemed like an hour, the women had peeled off after a friend had miraculously gotten a cab, but I continued to sit, waiting for a trolley that would, in my mind, somehow take me to the hotel where I was staying at without actually knowing where or what it was. I guess I just thought it might be like a magic trolley, like the bus in My Neighbor Totoro. Finally, a man approached, stirring me out of my mind spin and chirped with that clipped Canadian pitch. No more trolleys. Fuck! Fuck, I was so fucked. I realized I had to go back to the house party to try and find my friend's brother, just to avoid going to a hospital ER to sleep. But I was too high to find the house again, and now the bars were closed, and the crowds were still thick in the streets, and I couldn't think straight, so I summoned up enough focus to hatch a plan. I decided to try and retrace my path to the bar from the hotel by sight, based on the location of the CN Tower, an iconic, very tall tower in Toronto. The one thing I knew was that the CN Tower was visible from the cab to the horseshoe, so maybe I could find a path where the iconic and extremely tall CN Tower appeared in my vantage point the same way as when I saw it on the way, but in reverse. Follow me? I was convinced this theory would work, and somehow I would eventually land at the hotel, whose name, still, I did not remember. But I figured I couldn't remember the name because I was high, and I knew that when I stopped being high, it would come back to me, but I also felt sure that I would never stop being high forever and ever. So I just started walking while looking up at the CN Tower, and when the tower was obscured by a building, I felt increasingly high and panicked, and in response, scurried to find the tower again, like a terrified puppy. The CN Tower was now the center of the universe, and my umbilical cord to a fragile sense of reality. I must have walked some 20 minutes, and the tower was a good ways off from where it had started in my eyeline, so I felt like I was making progress. But this notion was quickly met with the stark realization that I was in the middle of nowhere, in some kind of barren warehouse area, and the streets were empty save for the very occasional passing car. This brought me back to my natural state of pure panic, but I had my tower, that tireless, immovable tower, my lighthouse, and then a jolt from the dark. Hey, faggot! I looked down, and there were 4 teenagers. They were in a phalanx, and I was sort of relieved, but for the hey faggot part. Where are you going, faggot? Okay, so he was sticking with the faggot thing, but there was still a glimmer of hope that they could help. Maybe I thought faggot was a familiar, friendly greeting in Toronto, like mate in Britain. To my hotel. To his hotel. A classic familiar bit of repartee that always signals bad things to come. When someone repeats what the other is saying in a slightly mocking fashion, a very common refrain signaling the beginning of hundreds and thousands of fights since the beginning of time. I'm lost, actually.
The faggot is lost.
I only then started to realize that I was being gay-bashed. I pivoted to quickly provide insignificant details as an attempt to stall the inevitable. I can't find my hotel. I'm visiting here. I'm American.
An American faggot.
I couldn't help laughing because of the way this kid said an American faggot. It was actually poetic, with the combination of his thick Canadian accent and those choice and very strange few words. It was like the title of a lost Walt Whitman poem. But my laugh struck the wrong chord for them.
What are you laughing at, faggot?
Less Walt Whitman now. Then he pushed me hard, and I was like a rag doll anyway, but being that high, I just toppled over. In these strange, heightened moments, the mind works quickly, intuitively. I had been assessing the situation subconsciously, and I knew what I needed to do. This was a classic case of appear weak when you are strong, and strong when you are weak. One swift blow to their leader, the loud one, the one who pushed me down and stood over me with a Cujo glower, and the others would cave and either scurry away or take me as their new leader. It was clear as Canadian mist, just as it is foretold and immemorial. I would quickly stand and punch him right in the neck, crushing his homophobic Adam's apple and choking his breath, leaving him helpless and buckled over in defeat. Instead, as they gathered around in a fashion that was highly suggestive, me kneeling, I seized this pivotal moment and said, "Who wants to get blown by the faggot first?" Let's be honest, I can't punch. A stillness cloaked the scene like a cold calm before the rogue wave hits. The leader looked appalled, like genuinely appalled. It was the invitation they had been waiting for, and now they had their act of war. I braced for the kick in the head, but instead came a blinding light and the sound of a loud horn blaring. The kids scattered, and directly in front of me, a car with its headlights on appeared. A woman stepped out, but I couldn't really see her in the lights, and then she just got back in the car and drove away, and I was left alone, shaking, less high from fear, and it immediately occurred to me. The Windsor Arms Hotel! The next night, we met my friend's brother again for dinner, and this time he brought his other brother. Afterwards, we were out, and he handed me a joint. Despite my better instincts, I took a small puff. It wouldn't be like that again, not like last night. I only smoked a tiny amount. 7 seconds passed, and I went right back to losing my shit. And then, a desperate retreat to the Windsor Arms, where I decided to pace around the outside perimeter of the hotel over and over and over. I told Amy to stay in the entranceway so I knew she would be there. I walked around possibly 30 times, maybe more. Finally, close to dawn, I went up to the room to sleep it off. That's how you show a girl a good time in Canada. My failed weed strain reviews. Singapore Math. A hybrid strain, Singapore Math boasts a small, tightly wound bud that packs a huge punch, a real hi-ya. Singapore Math produces an ultra-disciplined effect with strong cerebral overtones. It's a real left side of the brain experience, bringing on waves upon waves of logical rushes that cascade like a consistent system of equations. With hints of cherry and citrus, this high-performing buzz does carry with it some hardcore self-doubt and bouts of over-politeness. Also, some have described stiffness in movement and manner, along with perma-smile. I highly recommend the strain if you like an intelligent, respectful stone with huge interior baggage and an abiding impulse to overwork. But I would avoid driving after smoking Singapore Math. It will aggravate other drivers. Kentucky Coal.
This S1 cultivar has royal origins. Many believe it's the result of a cross between two of the same family of seeds, which gives Kentucky Coal its unusual appearance and powerfully dense attributes. Kentucky Coal is a workhorse that delivers a very introverted experience. Some would say too introverted, as in cut off from normal society and its highfalutin moral compass. Woodsy and dark, Kentucky Coal is long-lasting and stridently opinionated, bringing its smoker a creamy sanctimony, followed by a radical sense of insularity. This is a great toke for just hanging out alone with your loved ones, or cousins, or sister, or uncle, and getting down and dirty. Fratricide. There's nothing commonplace about this florid, richly green sativa indica blend. It's all brawn and not much brain. Creative types need not apply, as this muscly buzz does not take no for an answer. On smoking fratricide, a blanket sensation of entitlement washes over you, making this an ideal bud to share with buds who are also of the mindset that no consequence is too damaging. It's a real team effort high. One downside to this musky blend is the aftermath, which can be a bit prickly. But don't worry, your parents and or a white judge will probably bail you out. Daddy issues. Sharp and unforgiving, this bitter bud is the hard pillow on the bed, the one you try and avoid but somehow end up sleeping on. This is a hard smoke to swallow, and it leaves a deep feeling of regret and existential dread, with a lingering premonition that things will just get worse. The high then morphs into a growing parental anxiety about future unfulfilled burdens. Finally, daddy issue snowballs into a revolving sense of the cycles of eternity, of knowing that your life is connected to all life before it and all life that follows, and that you've only contributed to that and that alone, which ends up being a devastating truth. By the way, don't smoke this Pandora's box too late at night. You gotta take your kid to school in the morning. Tween green. Middle school can be a high-pressure environment. You've got to dutifully perform at school, stay connected socially, feel vulnerable all the time, and then go home and get shit for all of that. These trying years can have lasting effects, and this strain is the perfect antidote for them. So I'm not advocating tween smoking, but I am advocating tween green for those people stuck in their memories of the many horrible experiences middle school can bring. This is a nice, smoothed-out ride with intermittent flashes of the distant memory of a kid calling you fat fuck, or another kid dumping out a salt shaker on your head in the cafeteria because you like disco, callback, or you having your period all over your beige pants in the middle of social studies. Kosher Kush. Next year in Jerusalem. Sometimes the rigors of the modern high are too much to take. Sometimes we crave a simpler high, one that foregoes the imposing freedoms of the infinite permutations a typical high can bring. Sometimes we just want a radically narrow high, what some would call a purposeful high. The Double K offers this with a vengeance. But don't sell your donkey before you build your cart. The Double K comes with a lot of baggage. Maybe it's better explained sermonically. There is an old story, oft-told, about a farmer who lived in a small hut with his wife and his baby. For months and months, no rain came, and the farmer was hard-pressed to grow the crops necessary to sustain him and his family. Every day he would sit in the field and pray to God for rain to nourish the soil to grow the crops. Then one day the wife came with her baby to the man who sat in his arid field, and she showed him the baby's penis, which was red and irritated on the tip. She was worried that the baby was carrying disease. Suddenly, as from nowhere, a torrential rain came. The farmer was overjoyed, and it rained and rained. For weeks, the rains came, and the farmer sat in his hut waiting for it to stop, but it never did. What he assumed was a gift became a curse, for his fields flooded, and he could still not grow any crops. He then knew that the baby's red penis was a very convoluted test from God to make things that appear good actually bad. Now, to this day, the Jewish people cut the tips off their babies' penises and do very little farming. Kosher Kush can be a bit like this test, so best be careful not to apply too much significance to what you smoke, or you may get stuck in your ways, and that ends up hurting babies. Chapter 13. How I Failed to Sell a Pilot. I spent my 20s pretty much getting fired from a bunch of waitering jobs, but I did finally land a steady gig stacking books at the Cambridge Public Library in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It was a pretty good job if you enjoyed public masturbation and cleaning up after public masturbation. It was also good if you liked to get paid less than $13,000 a year. I spent a lot of my nights then trying to do comedy at places like Catch a Rising Star and Stitches Comedy Club with various sketch troupes. Years went by, and I still can't honestly say that I had any real ambition to do comedy as a profession. The comedians around me who performed night in and night out, their aim was pretty apparent: become successful at comedy. At first, I thought of comedy as a way to avoid a profession, but via all these people I was around, very driven comedy minds, I learned to mimic their drive to pursue comedy as an actual career. But that doesn't go without error. Having been part of many sketch shows and appearing in a couple of animated shows, I started to slowly develop a comedy writing career. Pitching and writing shows is a precarious endeavor. I have written a good number of sitcom scripts with the hopes that they get developed into series. But writing television pilots can become a tedious task because often you have a good idea for a show, it gets sold, and then you spend time and energy writing it, and then the network takes months to get back to you, and their notes come in, and they want to make changes, and the process becomes very entangled and unclear. By this time, you are so far away from the moment of conception that the idea itself starts to seem terrible and fruitless, so you end up rooting for its demise. It's like any relationship, really. My first script for a network was called Squash Club. It was 1996, and I had just moved to New York and was, for some reason, playing a lot of squash at a club downtown. I didn't really have a day job, so it was a good time to score open court. The script, appropriately, was about a young man who played squash with old men in New York City, and they became his only friends. It was really about not wanting to be young, something I strongly felt in real life. Being young means you have so much left to do, but being old means just settling in quietly for the remaining days. You know, just tucking yourself in with a bowl of popcorn or some soup and welcoming the final breath. That's how I imagine my death, being poisoned by soup. Anyway, the pilot script was declined and I moved on to the next idea, which was subsequently rejected, and so on, for many, 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 many years. Also, there's this sort of Damocles-type feeling about starting the process, and it's twofold, because, one, once you start, you're almost certain it will reap no reward and die on the vine. And two, if the show does get picked up, but the idea was concocted more out of necessity than inspiration, it's less than ideal knowing you have to helm a show you just came up with as an exercise in coming up with something for the sake of coming up with something. Oh, and for money. It turns out writing pilots is a pretty low-paying affair, considering the amount of time invested, most of which is waiting for a response. Basically, writing pilots for television has a very low rate of return emotionally and financially. That's some uplifting advice for all you young writers getting into television. I am the king of gloomy feedback, by the way. Around the same time as the writing of Squash Club, I remember going to a high school as a volunteer to an enrichment program for kids where I met with several classes to talk about animation and script writing. After the classes ended, there was a final ceremony in the school's auditorium where the volunteers sat on stage and went down the line giving their final thoughts to the students. All successful artists and actors and musicians, all so incredibly positive, like, never stop striving and working towards your dream, and don't let anything stand in the way of going for it. An actor, I think it was Matthew Lillard, spoke right before me, and he was really fired up. He gave this rousing speech about achieving goals by pushing to be who you want to be. It hit all the major notes and, undeniably, was a bit of hokum, but it was well-delivered and incredibly well-received hokum. Kids love positive reinforcement. I resented his success and his positive reinforcement, and then it was my turn. I went for some irony and told the kids as a counterpoint not to push so hard because going for it is annoying. So many blank stares. Even my fellow volunteers on stage, none of whom I knew, looked at me sideways. It was a really poorly timed joke. You never know when a joke is going to fall completely flat. I've had many jokes in this vein produce rotten results. One that springs to mind was when, during the era of answering machines, I recorded my and my girlfriend Amy's outgoing message so it said, "Hi, you've reached John and Amy. We're not here right now, but if you need to reach us, please call," and then I gave the number of the White House. Not a great joke. But when Amy's grandmother tried to reach her, she called the White House and started leaving messages for someone there who actually shared Amy's name. In the end, I made an old woman very confused and disappointed that her granddaughter was not working for President Clinton. Back in the late 90s, my friend and I sold a pilot to NBC. The show's premise was pretty simple. It was about two 20-something guys who were going nowhere financially, so they decide just to retire and move into one of their grandparents' gated community in Florida to save money and scam old people. I can't remember the title, but I imagine it was something like Early Retirement, or Gated, or Buddies, or Moving In, or Hi Grandma, I'm Home, or And Bubby Makes Three, or It Takes a Retirement Village. When we started writing, I suggested that we might take a bit of the money we were going to make and go to Florida, where my brother-in-law's parents lived, and spend a night at their Jewish retirement village to do some embedded research for the script. They lived in Boca Raton, the Babylon of Jewish retirement, an endless stream of golf course condominium communities separated by strip malls. Now, I'm not exactly very close with my brother-in-law's father and mother, but they were gracious enough to agree to show us around their community. When we arrived, we told them we just wanted to tag along with them as they did what they would normally do so we could get a sense of the lifestyle. It was pretty much what you would imagine, a trip to the clubhouse and the pool for lunch, then a trip to a nearby strip mall to some weird gambling facility that kind of looked illegal. All the windows were blacked out, but inside there were just slot machines. After that, the requisite 5 p.m. discount buffet dinner at an all-you-can-eat Chinese food place. At the dinner, crammed into a booth, the father told us how he was the community's head writer for his theater group that put on in-house plays and performances, and went into a detailed description of his body of work, which consisted mainly of Jewish parody versions of post-war musicals. So, for example, the Jewish West Side Story would be West Side Schnorrer, or the Jewish Cats, Cats with a K, or the Jewish My Fair Lady, My Fair Canadal. A simple, refillable model for quick impact entertainment for old Jews. Basically, any Yiddish pun would suffice. That's a special talent, though, writing stuff like that. I pulled my co-writer aside and hit him with what I thought was a very interesting proposal. We could take a decent but minority share percentage out of our paycheck for the script and have my brother-in-law's father write the whole thing and then turn that into the studio just to see what happens. Again, in my spirited tradition, a way for me to make less money than I could, but in this case, the same for my co-writer, who was not as thrilled with the idea. I convinced him, next to a heaping glossy load of chicken and broccoli under a sneeze guard, and we went back to our table to offer our new writer the opportunity. He was thrilled. So now, to summarize, we were paying something around $4,000 out of what I think was about $20,000 total, to a retired shoe salesman we only knew peripherally to write a whole sitcom script for us to turn in lieu of something written by us as a joke. Or not. And let's be clear, money was an issue for us at that time, and giving away 20% off the top also factors into the normal deductions one takes in this line of work, where we also have to pay off our agent, our manager, and our taxes. So this joke would cost us 20% more than the 50% taken out of our payment. We would end up with around $2,500 for the script each, minus the money we were also paying to go to Boca for research, which was also my idea. So, most would say this was a lark, but maybe his script would be good and he'd become the next septuagenarian head writer of a network sitcom. I'm saying, in these kinds of experiments, there is no set conclusion, though one would guess it would not work out well for any of us. But like I've been trying to tell you, this is my unique talent, to successfully muck up any plan. It stems from a complex that manifests as my taking pleasure in hurting myself and others simultaneously, a real Freudian one-man band. Back in New York, around 3 weeks later, we received a script about 40 pages long, with little to no connection to our story, and with an extremely disproportionate amount of Viagra jokes. It wasn't at all what the network would want, but exactly what we wanted for the network, at least for the reaction. Also, I will point out, this was in no way a failure on the part of the father-in-law. He wrote a whole sitcom script in 3 weeks with no television experience, despite, I gather, a heavy reliance on Jewish joke books, which could be construed as plagiarism, but I am not here to judge his methods. I'm here to make people uncomfortable. Also, if no action had been taken in that Chinese buffet that night in Boca Raton, I would not have this to share with you. Here is a snippet from the pilot script written by my brother-in-law's father, Mal. Man 1. Ernie's wife asked him if he remembered if they had a mutual orgasm. He answered, "No, we had State Farm." Man 2. "Hey, what do you get when you mix Viagra with your baked beans for supper?" All. "What do you get?" Man 2. "A stiff wind." Man 1. "There was a truckload of Viagra hijacked last night. The police were told to be on the lookout for a gang of hardened criminals." Man 2. "How about the old guy in the nursing home? They gave him Viagra every night to keep him from falling out of bed." Man 1. "Did you hear about the old geezer who said to his doctor, 'I think I'm going deaf in my right ear'? The doctor said, 'No wonder you can't hear. You have a suppository stuck in there.' The old geezer said, 'Now I know what happened to my hearing aid.'" Now, I like a good Viagra joke. Actually, not really. But 300 in a row gets to be a little much. And the script was magnificently outdated, but to be fair, perfectly outdated. George Eliot and Raymond Chandler didn't write until later in their lives, and think how much better Middlemarch would have been with more, or any, Jewish jokes, or erectile dysfunction jokes. But this was definitively not a modern American sitcom. It was more like Soviet psyops. So the plan unfolded. We sent his script as ours and waited. About 3 weeks later, we got on the phone with the executives from NBC to discuss the draft and had a gloriously uncomfortable notes call. They tried as best they could to politely explain that the script seemed to be trying too hard to capture the characters of a Florida old-age community. They were expecting something more from the perspective of the young characters and felt there were way too many old-timey Jewish jokes. But they did break it down and give suggestions on how to retool it in great depth. At the end of the call, we revealed what we did, and there was a pregnant pause. Like, more of a baffled, "Why would you do this?" than a, "That's an amusing gag." We did make them read and pull together a half hour of notes on a script that we didn't write. Anyway, I thought it was funny, and they ended up passing on our deal. A win-win in my book. And a win for my brother-in-law's father, but a loss for my writing partner, who I still feel I owe money to for souring any prospects with that network for some time. But we will always have that one night in Boca when hope was alive, and we were young, and they were old, and money meant nothing to me, and Chinese food was $3.99. As a quick addendum, in keeping slightly on message, I'd like to offer a side story in the spirit of confused grandmothers and Jewish jokes. Maybe my reputation for unfortunate phone pranking precedes me, or maybe it was just an unusual coincidence. When my grandmother Sadie was alive, I would frequently speak to her, at least once a week. She lived alone in the Bronx after my grandfather passed away. She was an incredible woman, small, sturdy, almost indestructible. Even in her 90s, she lugged groceries up the steep hill to her apartment complex. One day, she called me and asked me if I was feeling better. I said, "Why do you ask?" "Because you were so sick the last time you called, Johnny." "Grandma, I haven't been sick in over a year." "Well, you certainly sounded it," she explained. "Why?" I asked. "Because you sounded all stuffed up and asked me if I was alone and what I was wearing, and when I told you I was in my house coat, you started to breathe heavily, and I kept saying, 'Johnny, are you all right?' But you kept breathing heavily, then you moaned and hung up." that wasn't me, Grandma.
Then who else could it have been?
Chapter 14. Prince Edward Island and How I Failed to Take a Walk in the Woods. As I previously mentioned, when I was 12, my parents sent me to that 4-H camp, mainly because my friend was going, and his family had horses on their small farm in Westboro, Massachusetts, making him a horse guy and someone who actually wanted to go to a horse camp. I, on the other hand, was allergic to every land animal imaginable. I couldn't even have a hamster in my house or I would break into hives. My mother also had a phobia of dogs. Whenever a dog came near, she would turn into a statue, unable to talk. This would make for some interesting scenarios when neighbors would come by walking their dogs. It was always a one-way conversation. Neighbor: hello, Shirley. My mom: frozen. Neighbor: how's Howie doing? My mom: frozen. Neighbor: hi, John. Me: hi. Neighbor: well, nice to see you, Shirley. My mom: frozen. Neighbor: Jesus, what a fucking jerk. Eventually, the dog owners in my neighborhood became aware of her phobia and learned my mother wasn't some monumental asshole or some KGB agent who spoke no English sent to destroy America. Anyway, as you can glean, animals were not our thing. Horse camp? I was dreading it. I knew it would be a week of me wheezing and missing my phobic mommy. But imagine, to learn how to ride a horse. That's the stuff of warriors and princes, and peasants and serfs. The camp was about a 45-minute drive from my house, and I got dropped off with my duffel bag and met up with my horse friend. At the time, he was really into girls, and he immediately started rating them during the introduction meeting in the main cabin as all the campers were gathered. For him, this was the pinnacle of excitement, an overnight camp with horses and girls. For me, this was a total nightmare, an overnight camp with horses and girls. I bristled at the thought of meeting girls with labored, allergic breathing, even though there's nothing sexier than a good, hearty wheeze to impress a woman. The first task was to get to the stables to meet the horses and get a basic sense of what the daily regimen would be. Wheezing ensued as the counselors introduced us all to the horses that I would hate riding for the next week. After, we went to the main hall to have dinner. With a semi-obstructed airway, I tried to get my food down. I knew I would spend my time at this camp exclusively with the camp nurse. Then, suddenly, out of nowhere, there was a muffled scream. Then from across the room, a girl, maybe about 13 years old, stumbled from the bathroom, her hands held up over her head with blood running down her arms. Counselors escorted her out quickly. We all just sat there in silence. No one knew what was going on. For a long time, we sat until an ambulance arrived, the flickering red lights filling the room. Finally, the camp director came in and announced that a girl had cut her wrists in the bathroom in a suicide attempt. It was a bit stunning that he didn't at least play it down a bit. Horse people, though, don't mince words. He invited any camper to call their parents to pick them up in the event that they did not want to continue based on what had happened. My friend sat there stunned. A few kids got up and headed for the door. I looked at my friend, took a shallow breath that made a high-pitched sound, and got up to leave. I drove home with this strange feeling of relief, shaded by the tragic circumstance of a girl who, out of nowhere, at some remote 4-H camp, cut both her wrists. Maybe she hated the thought of going to horse camp more than me, or maybe she was just troubled, but either way, her actions set me free. I hope she's okay, but to this day, whenever I see a horse, I do think of that girl. When I was in my late 30s, I wanted to take a trip with Amy before we had our baby. She was about 6 months pregnant, and we both felt we needed one last fling with freedom before we were saddled with the excruciating pleasure of raising a child. She wanted to go to Mexico, to the beach. I had never been. I was slightly uncomfortable with the idea of Mexico. I was sure it was great, but I have an aversion to great. Everyone I know had been to Mexico and enjoyed it. Therefore, why go? It's like a compulsion to reject norms. My feeling is, why go to a luxury resort when you could go to rural Minnesota and tour a packing house, or to Peaks Island, Maine, to go to the Umbrella Cover Museum? It was almost winter, so naturally, I suggested the most inopportune place, Nova Scotia. Are you sure you want to go to Nova Scotia off-season when Mexico would be perfect? She said. It'd be more interesting, I answered. We flew to Halifax and stayed at a small B&B situated on a promontory overlooking a quiet harbor. It was one of those bed and breakfasts where people are friendly and everyone eats breakfast together. Because neither of us is friendly, this was extremely awkward. The next day we decided to leave Nova Scotia altogether.